On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, April 10. Florida is the worst state in the nation for renters, according to a Consumer Affairs report. The research team found high housing costs and a lack of statewide protections for tenants as the main factors behind the ranking. The report gave Florida a total score of a little more than 30 out of 100, which placed it as the 50th state in the country. The state's median monthly rent is close to $1,700, ranking 8th highest in the country, and it's among the fastest rising, too. Nationwide, Floridians spend the largest amount on rent at more than 37% of income. Rental vacancies rank towards the highest in the nation. The analysis was also critical of a lack of Florida state laws in any of the four tenant protection areas the researchers evaluated. Researchers at Colorado State University are predicting a somewhat below-average Atlantic hurricane season for 2026. While an average hurricane season sees 14 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes, the researchers predicted a total of 13 named storms. Of those, they predict 6 will be hurricanes, with 2 of those being Category 3 or higher. They attribute the potential down year to the likely development of a robust El Nino. Yesterday, the Tampa Bay Rays unveiled the framework for their proposal to build a new stadium in Tampa, and it relies heavily on public funding. As outlined in the released Memorandum of Understanding, the Rays are seeking more than $1 billion in public funds to help build the new home for the team on the Dale Mabry campus of Hillsborough Community College. While Hillsborough's Board of County Commissioners and the Tampa City Council are expected to cast votes on the stadium agreement this month, questions remain about where the money would come from. The team is committed to paying more than half the cost. Meanwhile, a poll among Hillsborough County voters showed they'd like to have the Rays in Tampa, but a majority reject the use of sales tax to pay for the stadium. This has been Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, April 10.
Truly Valued is a nonprofit serving Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties through youth leadership, mentoring, family support, and restorative justice programs. Their work helps youth, families, and justice-involved individuals build life skills, strengthen relationships, and move toward positive futures. More information about Truly Valued and its program is available at trulyvalued.org. Fogartyville is a place where local music, performance, and community come together in a real way. On April 15th and 16th, during the 2026 Giving Challenge, we're bringing that energy into a full 24-hour experience. From noon to noon, we'll have live radio, performances, and events as part of the Be the One-a-thon. During that time, donations between $25 and $100 will be matched, making every gift even more impactful. Right now, we're asking you to be a part of it early by committing to give during that 24-hour window. If Fogartyville has ever meant something to you, this is your chance to be the one who keeps it going.
Volunteers are an essential part of what we do at WSLR in Fogartyville. The voices you hear hosting local shows on WSLR are volunteers. The people greeting and seating you at Fogartyville events are volunteers. You can serve on one of our committees, assist in the office, or be a part of our news team. The volunteer application is available on our website, WSLR.org, under the support tab, or give us a call in the office at 941-894-6469 to learn more.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Lorini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. This week, the phrase Taco Tuesday got a whole new meaning and reinforced the reality that the best move he who would be king makes is to back off a promise. Originally, the moniker Taco was tagged to the Orange Menace after threatened tariffs were rescinded as markets tanked, which is short for Trump always chickens out. This time, the world breathed a sigh of relief that the threat of eliminating an entire civilization was not carried out. But I must ask, who does that? Threaten to destroy an entire country with close to 100 million people? Sounds like something a Marvel villain would say, not the president of the U.S., who was once referred to as the leader of the free world. Next week, the 2026 Giving Challenge is happening April 15th through the 16th, a 24-hour giving event from noon to noon supporting nonprofits across our region. Here at WSLR in Fogartyville, we're turning it into something special with 24 hours of live programming, performances, and community events, and everyone is invited to participate. During that 24-hour window, donations between $25 and $100 will be matched, so your gift goes even further. We're asking listeners to commit to being part of it by making a pledge to give when the challenge begins. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Andrew Sparr, president of the Florida Education Association, breaks down the education policies passed so far this year, including another effort to bust his union, the largest in the state. But first, hear this story that details just how the increasing fuel prices are affecting businesses for whom gas and diesel are major expenses, and how that is trickling down to all of us. Surging gas prices since the Iran war began have motorists everywhere complaining. But for many Florida businesses, the pain from the sharp increase in fuel costs extends far beyond the pump. For small to mid-sized companies, especially those in transportation, construction, and service industries, fuel is not just a line item. It's a direct driver of operating costs, said Skip Lilly, sales and marketing manager for Vision HR Inc., a Daytona Beach firm that provides payroll, human relations, employee benefits, and commercial insurance services to businesses throughout Florida and 14 other states. When fuel prices rise, it impacts everything from delivery expenses to employee commuting, ultimately puts pressure on margins and pricing, he said. As of March 3rd, the statewide average of regular gasoline in Florida has risen to $4.22 a gallon, up $1.34 since the Iran war began on February 28th. Diesel has climbed to $5.81 a gallon, up $2.13 over the past month, according to AAA, the Auto Club. Gas prices still have a long way to go to reach the all-time high in Florida, which peaked in June 2022 at $4.89 a gallon because of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Diesel, on the other hand, has already set new record high this past week when it hit $5.82 a gallon on April 2nd. Higher fuel prices mean the cost to fill up at gas stations in Florida is now as much as $21 more for sedans, $32 more for sport utility vehicles, and $48 more for pickup trucks using regular gasoline, and $77 more for those using diesel. For an 18-wheeler semi-trucks that use diesel and have tanks that hold up to 300 gallons, filling up in Florida now costs $641.70 more than it did before the war. That means long-haul truckers now pay a total of as much as $1,744 to fuel up in Florida, based on statewide average price for diesel as of April 3rd. Commercial truckers typically refuel one to every 3 days. Economists say the surge in diesel prices, which have risen faster than gasoline, have already started adding to the already rising cost of groceries and other products. Those increases, for the most part, have been in small ways that may not be readily apparent to consumers, such as adding a few cents to the price of bags of lettuce. That increase could accelerate if global crude prices, a major determining factor in the price of gasoline, diesel, propane, and jet fuel, remain elevated for an extended period of time because of the Iran war and blockage of the Strait of Hormuz. Several small business owners in Florida who spoke with the USA Today network say they have held off passing the increased fuel costs to customers, at least for now. In the case of Daytona Beverages, the owner of the family business intended to stick with the fuel surcharge they set for the year prior to the Iranian war. We only set a price increase on our products to customers once a year, and we set it this year in February before we knew what would happen, said Chris Bowler, president of the company. Despite claims by the administration that drug prices are going down, industry watchdogs say the opposite is true. Drug pricing watchdogs worry that President Donald Trump's plan to assess 100% tariffs on some imported brand-name drugs could lighten patients' pocketbooks. But that fate is far from certain, given caveats the Trump administration announced as part of its sweeping April 2nd order on tariffs for imported brand-name pharmaceuticals. Drug makers that agree to move production to the United States will face a 20% tariff, while they transition in no tariff if they also agree to lower prices to most favored nations levels paid by other countries, according to the order. The full tariff will be levied if drug production isn't in the United States in 4 years. The tariffs assessed to larger drug companies will take effect July 31st unless companies commit to price concessions and bolstering domestic manufacturing. Smaller drug manufacturers will have until September 29th to comply. Merith Basie, CEO of Patients for Affordable Drugs, warned that terms for most favored nation drug pricing deals already announced have not delivered meaningful savings for the vast majority of American patients. What Americans need is structural reform that will be long-lasting, Basie told USA Today. What they don't need is temporary voluntary agreements that are opaque and unclear. She added that Americans are already struggling with the price of everyday goods, and when it comes to life-saving or essential medicines, any small increase in the cost of drugs you have to pay for monthly can have a significant impact. Trump has also made most favored nations deals a centerpiece of his administration's effort to lower drug prices for consumers. The administration has announced deals with 16 of the 17 major drug manufacturers that it sent letters to in 2025 seeking price concessions on brand-name drugs. Regeneron, the only company that did not reach a most favored nations pricing deal, expects to reach a drug pricing agreement in the near future, a Regeneron spokesperson said. While touting these deals as a boon for consumers during an Oval Office announcement, the Trump administration hasn't publicly released terms of the voluntary agreements. The administration's drug pricing website, TrumpRx, listed prices of more than five dozen brand-name fertility, insulin, weight loss, and other medications as of April 2nd. The website doesn't process insurance claims, instead directing cash-paying consumers to drug manufacturers' websites or coupons that could be used at pharmacies. Most people with health insurance will likely use their plan's drug benefits to fill prescriptions. Still, affordability is a concern for most Americans. About 6 in 10 Americans said they are worried about being able to afford their prescription drug costs, according to a March survey from KFF, a nonpartisan policy nonprofit. 4 in the 10 said that they saved costs by skipping doses, not filling prescriptions, or taking other cost-saving measures. We end up paying for it one way or another, said Antonia Sicasia, CEO of Brooklyn of 46 Brooklyn, and a drug pricing expert. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Governor DeSantis is confident the Supreme Court will allow the midterm gerrymandering. Governor Ron DeSantis is confident that the U.S. Supreme Court will rule as he wants in a case governing congressional maps, saying that one of the court's staunchest conservatives is already writing the majority opinion. In Tampa, DeSantis said, "We know how the Supreme Court case is going to come out at this point, and I don't think there's much dispute about that, and I think Justice Samuel Alito is writing the opinion. If that's the case, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 could be scuttled, and targets could include seats held by South Florida Democrats Sheila Shefferless McCormick and Frederica Wilson in Florida's 20th and 24th congressional districts." DeSantis' reveal of process on the high court was a response to a question from a reporter about whether Louisiana versus Callis would be decided in time for the state to be able to rely on a court decision to drive its redrawing of the map. The special session set to begin at noon on April 20th and extend no later than April 24th will consider legislation relating to new congressional map and allocate money for any legal challenges that may result. "I think that's appropriate, whether the decision comes before we do it or after," DeSantis said of the special session timeline. "It'll obviously come sometime between now and the end of June. Normally cases in October would come down sometime in the spring, but this is a case where we're probably going to have the dissents or whatnot. But I'm very confident if there's a map that is consistent with what that opinion will eventually say, then that's going to be the map. That's what's going to be upheld going forward. So there's a variety of reasons we will be able to do it." Florida's delegation already is heavily Republican split, with only 8 Democrats and 28-person delegation. DeSantis previously said he thought Florida could have as many as 5 more seats under maps he deemed gypped the state in favor of blue states that allegedly count illegal aliens as part of the metric. But some incumbents, including U.S. Reps Mario Diaz-Balart, Carlos Jimenez, Greg Stube, and Daniel Webster, are among those who worry an aggressive map will put their seats in play. Republicans cling to a 217-214 advantage in the current Congress as the midterms loom, and with Democrats anticipating a potential wave election and aggressively redistricting in states like California and Virginia on partisan grounds, GOP-controlled states like Florida are working to firm things up where they can, even if some say it's a risky play. Democrats are working to be sure no elections for state seats go unopposed. David Silberberg may serve as the poster child for the progress Project 140 is making in its drive to ensure that every Florida House and Senate race this fall has a Democrat on the ballot. Only a month ago, there were 11 state Senate and 47 state House races with no Democratic candidates, meaning automatic wins for Republicans, and worse, depressed turnout among Democrats whose votes are needed in crucial statewide elections, such as those for the governorship and the U.S. Senate. In the past month, that number of empty spots on the ballot has been whittled down by about a dozen if candidates have stepped up. Data shows that when there are no blank spots on the ballot, turnout is higher, and the midterm elections will turn on turnout. Just a week ago, for example, there was no Democrat running for the seat being vacated by former Senate President Kathleen Posadomo, a Republican from Naples. It's a ruby-red district, and any Dem running in that area for either House or Senate is in for an uphill battle. Some may think that it's hopeless, but you have to see the big picture. When candidates step up for tough fights like this, they bring along supporters, fundraisers, and door knockers who otherwise might sit the election out. This stimulates overall voter turnout, even if those candidates ultimately can't beat the overwhelming local odds. The extra voters they bring to the polls, who also cast ballots in statewide races, may make the difference in important close elections. Consider the year 2000, when Florida was the epicenter of a national controversy, the election between Vice President Al Gore and Governor George W. Bush of Texas was so close that it ended up in the Supreme Court. By the end, the court stepped in, stopped the recount of the ballots. Bush was ahead by only 537 votes. There were numerous uncontested legislative seats during that election, giving Republicans easy wins. What if more Democrats had volunteered to run? Would those few extra votes have made a difference? It's certainly possible. This is an unusual midterm election. Republicans are reeling from an avalanche of bad news, and President Trump's collapsing popularity may depress the Republican turnout and votes, not only among GOP members, but also among right-leaning independents who overwhelmingly are disillusioned with Trump's behavior. Witness the recent state house victory of Emily Gregory, a Democrat and political newcomer, who beat her Trump-endorsed Republican opponent in Palm Beach County's special election in a Republican district that includes Trump's Mar-a-Lago. Silverberg seized the opportunity. His decision to jump in the fray was encouraged by a chance meeting with Margie Stein at a rally for U.S. Senate candidate Alex Vindman in Naples. Stein is the leader of Project 140, the independent candidate recruitment initiative, an initiative. Bemoaning the paucity of Democrats in the ballot, Stein asked Silverberg, "Why don't you run?" Until then, Silverberg had busied himself as the editor of the Paradise Progressive, a popular newsletter commenting on news affecting the Paradise Coast of Southwest Florida that is overlooked, ignored, or otherwise avoided by local traditional media. After talking to Stein, he decided to change roles from observer and commentator to candidate. "I finally got to the point where I couldn't sit on the sidelines anymore," he said. "I was urging other people to get involved, and the time came when I had to do it myself. The stakes are so high and the danger is so great that we all have to get out of our comfort zones or there won't be any comfort left. I was very comfortable in my zone, but sometimes you just have to take to the barricades." Although Silverberg has been involved in other candidates' campaigns in the past, this is his first time in the ring himself. Well, since high school, he said. He said one of the key points of his campaign will be the closure of Alligator Alcatraz, which is in the Senate district he's running for. Alligator Alcatraz is a moral stain. It's a financial drain, and it cannot remain, he says in one of his online messages to supporters. Real Americans don't build concentration camps. Real Americans liberate concentration camps. Make no mistake, Alligator Alcatraz is a concentration camp. Spending $1 million a day on this man's monstrosity when everyday Floridians are suffering is unacceptable. But when asked about the odds, he said, "If there ever was a year or an election cycle when things could change, this is it," he said. "People are fed up, they're waking up, and they just might do something new and surprising inside the voting." Data shows Florida Highway Patrol stop more Hispanics, even when they mislabeled them as white. Most Florida Highway Patrol troopers are classified as designated immigration officers, allowing them to stop, search, and question individuals based on immigration status. FHP signed the 287G agreement with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement in 2025, reviving a task force model that was disbanded in 2012 after the Department of Justice found it led to widespread racial profiling. Nearly all troopers now have that status. However, FHP's own data show that those powers were given to an agency that disproportionately penalizes Hispanic drivers for minor non-moving traffic offenses. TC Palm previously reported on its analysis that found statewide disparities in FHP traffic stops from 2018 to 2025. This article focused on some counties that have higher disparities than others. THC Palm found Hispanic drivers were 41% more likely than white drivers to be ticketed or arrested after being stopped for not wearing a seatbelt. Hispanic drivers were 17% more likely than white drivers to be charged for expired tags, window tint, and other non-moving violations. And FHP repeatedly recorded Hispanic drivers as white or other, obscuring useful data on traffic stop disparities. Commercial vehicle inspections rose 138% from 2024 to 25, which FHP has acknowledged is a tactic used to stop suspected undocumented immigrants. The starkest inequality was in Calhoun County in Florida's Panhandle, where FHP was more than twice as likely to ticket or arrest Hispanic drivers for minor non-moving traffic expenses. The second highest was Glades County in Central Florida, with troopers charging Hispanic drivers 83% more than white drivers for the same offenses. There is little disparity between FHP's treatment of Hispanic and white drivers in some of Florida's major metro areas. The most equal counties include Palm Beach, Hillsborough, Indian River, Osceola, Orange, Alachua, Citrus, St. John's, Jefferson, Okaloosa. These counties include such cities as West Palm Beach, Orlando, and Tampa. In Miami-Dade County, Hispanic drivers were 13% less likely than white drivers to be charged for minor traffic offenses. Troopers are required to report the initial reason for a traffic stop, so TC Palm's analysis focuses on drivers pulled over for non-moving offenses, which better captures differences in treatment because troopers have more discretion to issue warnings. When analyzing all traffic stops, the disparities between Hispanic and white drivers are much more pervasive. For example, Hispanic drivers are more than twice as likely to get pulled over for any reason in Nassau, Jackson, Washington, Liberty, and Glades counties. These counties are largely rural or suburban with small populations requiring few troopers on the highways. Studies show bias is often concentrated in a minority of officers within an agency. A 2021 study published by the nonpartisan American Economic Association found that 42% of FHP troopers practiced racial discrimination. These disparities are likely higher because FHP has a history of recording some Hispanic drivers as white or other in its traffic stop reports. One trooper patrolling Lake Worth Beach in Palm Beach County did not record ticketing a single Hispanic driver in the year, a WLRN report found. Lake Worth Beach is 50% Hispanic and 28% white, U.S. Census Bureau show. Hispanic drivers account for about 19% of FHP stops from 2018 to 2025, making up 28% of Florida's population, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. FHP also excluded data on Hispanics and Latinos in its 2020 Office of Inspector General's bias-based profiling review. It is the perception of the officer that matters when assessing race, said Jack McDivitt, author and former criminology professor at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. If everyone's white, then there's no disparity. Trump administration ends some transgender civil rights settlements. President Donald Trump's administration said it was terminating resolution agreements backing transgender students that prior administrations had reached with some school districts. The U.S. Education Department said it was terminating six resolution agreements reached through what was called the manipulation of Title IX. The Title IX civil rights statute bars the denial of benefits or discriminating in education on the basis of sex. Since taking office, Trump has cracked down on schools and colleges with executive orders and threats to freeze federal funds over issues like transgender rights, climate programs, diversity initiatives, and protests against Israel's war in Gaza. The Education Department said its Office for Civil Rights will no longer monitor or enforce deals reached with the Sacramento City Unified School District in California, the Cape Henlopen School District in Delaware, the Fife School District in Washington State, Delaware Valley School District in Pennsylvania, and La Mesa Spring Valley School District in California, and Taft College in California. School districts and college did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The Education Department statement did not elaborate on specifics of the terminations, which were reported earlier by the New York Times. Those civil rights settlements had aimed at ensuring the rights of transgender students to equal opportunity to an education, the newspaper reported. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Stay tuned to hear my interview with Andrew Spahr, but first, mark your calendar to be sure to visit the Giving Challenge website sometime between noon April 15th and noon April 16th to make a donation to WSLR. Donations from $25 to $100 will be matched.
I'm happy to welcome back Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, which is the state's largest association of professional employees, made up of more than 100 local unions and service unions from Pensacola to the Keys that represent more than, 120,000 educators and support staff. Is that right?
So that is correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, hey, thanks for coming on, Andrew. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Lou. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss some really important issues as it relates to public education in Florida.
Yeah, you know, to quote Yogi Berra, it seems like deja vu all over again. Another legislative session has passed yet another law to make it more difficult for public service and unions to form and exist, including those representing teachers, nurses, while police, fire, and corrections unions are exempt. Before we get into the reasons for that particular focus, tell us what those changes have been and what it means to Floridians, both in the unions and those that they serve.
Yeah, well, I think part of what we have to get at is why do they keep coming after educators in the state of Florida? You know, what is it that educators have done besides sacrifice their time, their energy, even their resources to make sure that every child in this state is cared for, is safe, and is getting an education they deserve and need. But you still have these politicians who are listening to these out-of-state billionaire-backed groups in trying to make it harder for teachers to do their job, for our bus drivers, cafeteria workers, custodians to be able to work in our districts. And what this new law does is, once again, it's making it harder and harder for public school employees as well as other public sector workers, including our professors and graduate assistants at our colleges and universities, city workers, people who make sure we have clean drinking water or that our parks are operating and clean and safe. All of those folks are included in this, with the exception of law enforcement and firefighters and correction officers. But what this bill does is it makes it harder for them to come together, for us to be able to come together, advocate for our profession, for our communities, and to be able to fight for a better life for ourselves, for our families, for our students, and for our communities. You know, it's just another law that creates hoops and obstacles. And at a time when we're all trying to figure out how we pay our bills, how we afford this, $4 plus gasoline, how expensive it is now every time you go to the grocery store. You know, everyone's trying to make ends meet, and we have lawmakers not doing anything to help us, but actually passing legislation that makes it harder for us.
Well, you know, it seems like for a while, you know, in this, I don't know, it seemed like it happened suddenly or it crept up on us, however you want to describe it, where suddenly the politicians, you know, just are very comfortable saying the quiet part out loud. And just, you know, blatantly going after anybody who they feel isn't supporting them in the polls. I mean, that's what it boils down to. You know, apparently, you know, studies show that teachers vote for Democrats. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But that's why they're targeted. Same thing with, nurses and that from, you know, what I've seen. That's why they support the police and fire and corrections, because they typically vote for Republicans. And I thought that when someone got elected to public office, they were supposed to be working for all the voters, not just the ones who voted for them, right?
Yeah. I want to say, I think it's even more sinister than that, unfortunately. And I think we're at a moment now where you're right, where people say stuff that's hurtful and harmful, and it seems like people are more focused on how to make it difficult for somebody else instead of how to make a better life for everybody, right? Which is really what our country's all about. It's always been about this idea of how does everyone get ahead? You know, at least in theory, that's what you want, and we know there's always been struggles. But right now, it seems very deliberate on how do I make your life harder rather than how do we all make our lives better. But I want to go a little deeper into this. I don't think this is so much about political retribution against educators and other public employees because of who they support politically. I think this is really targeted, even though nurses and city workers are and city bus drivers and others are included in this. The target was very clear when they were debating this bill. It was teachers. And why is it teachers? Well, because teachers are all about educating the next generation. And these same billionaire-backed groups that are coming after educators' rights to be able to come together, have a union, negotiate a contract for that union, which many of those negotiated items are not just about making it better for teachers and staff in our schools, it's also about making it better for students. But they also want to come after us because we speak up for kids, making sure they get the education they deserve, making sure that students, especially students with disabilities, are looked out for. And when you have these billionaire-backed groups coming after us and also going after public schools, saying we should divert billions of dollars away from public schools and there should be no accountability for those dollars that are diverted to voucher schools or charter schools or homeschooling situations. Those same groups are behind that, right? And that's the connection I think we need to make, that at the end of the day, this is also about, and probably more importantly, about ending public education as we know it in the state of Florida. And that's concerning because that means then we don't have an educated citizenry. That means we don't have the opportunities for success in life that we want all of our children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews to have.
And that is kind of the point of the public school system, the fact that our democracy can't operate effectively unless people know how to read, basically. I mean, to be kind of crass about it, and you're absolutely right about that. I've seen that from the beginning when Jeb Bush first started all this, that it seemed like, you know, him and his buddies, you know, decided that, you know, there's an awful lot of money in the pot there going to, you know, education. You know, how can we divert some of that to ourselves, basically? And that's
yeah, well, look,
you know. You know, Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say this. So if you look at the Florida Constitution, this is Article 9, Section 1 of the Florida Constitution. It's entitled Public Education. And I think it's important to hear this part for a minute. The education of children is the fundamental value of the people of the state of Florida. It is therefore a paramount duty of the state to make adequate provisions for the education of all children residing within its borders. adequate provision shall be made by law for a uniform, efficient, safe, secure, and high-quality system of free public schools that allows students to obtain a high-quality education, and for the establishment, maintenance, and operation of institutions of higher learning. That's what our Constitution says. And so we have to start asking the question, is Florida meeting the Constitution written by the people of the state, that starts out by saying that the people of this state value the education of children, and therefore we want a strong public school system? There was an Auditor General's report done just before the legislative session began, so it was done in the fall, and they had 17 recommendations about what needed to change with Florida's universal voucher program that the Auditor General said was creating a disparate treatment between public schools and this voucher program, that public schools were being disadvantaged by this law, that dollars were coming out of public schools and they weren't being accounted for, that students were appearing on rosters of public schools, which we count physically, and the voucher program, which no one could explain. And that led to a loss of dollars for public schools. When you hear about Sarasota County Public Schools right now talking about massive cuts, layoffs, increased class sizes, eliminating programs, all of this stuff, and we're hearing about this around the state, closing of schools, all of these things are driven by the fact that dollars are being diverted away and that Florida is 45th in the nation in funding for our public schools. We have a crisis in Florida, and that crisis in public education that we have is manufactured by policy, very bad policy, that is burdening and disadvantaging our public schools in order to promote the privatization through vouchers and charters of education, leading to two very unequal systems. One where if you have resources, you have a quality education, and if you don't, that education is going to be undermined and more difficult to achieve. And that's, it sounds like an apocalyptic kind of story, but that's the reality of what we're seeing play out right now in public schools. Look at what you see in the news every day about school districts across the state and the challenges and struggles they face. This is not something that's done because there's been poor management of school districts. This is something that's happening because of policy decisions made in Tallahassee by this governor and legislature.
Yeah, and just, to remind people that this, voucher program isn't chicken feed. It's well over $4 billion now. That basically goes to people, without a means test. I mean, originally they sold these deals for, underprivileged kids whose parents couldn't afford them to send them to a better school, or they got stuck in a bad school district, and it all sounds well and good. But that's not what this is about. This is about just, giveaway, to people who are perhaps already going to public schools and perhaps already going to a private school, and let's not forget that public schools are free for everybody, and that's the whole point of it. Every student in the state gets taken care of, whether they have money or not, in a public school, right? I mean, that's the value of it.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, look, our public schools are the place where every child can get an education. We welcome every child with open arms. We don't turn students away. Whether you're in a private school or a charter school or whatever the case may be, they can turn students away. And again, this isn't about do away with vouchers and charters. We're not suggesting that. What we're suggesting is there needs to be some equality among how we handle education in the state of Florida. And to your point, over $4 billion now, they're estimating it could grow to as much as $5 billion next year coming out of public schools, going to this universal voucher program, and upwards of 70% of the students who are receiving those vouchers have never stepped a foot in public schools. So these are dollars that are coming out that are not attached to kids, as they often say, and it's leading to these financial crises we're seeing across the state of Florida right now. And not only that, we have to acknowledge that with this massive teacher and staff shortage, my daughter, who is in 11th grade this year, She has now, five of the last 6 years has had a change and has not had a full complement of teachers all year. Five of the last 6 years, she has not had a full complement of teachers her entire year. That's concerning. That's very concerning because that is a disruption in the learning process when you don't have a teacher in the classroom the whole time. When you have a teacher in a classroom, 1 year she had her English teacher, she didn't have an English teacher to start the year. It wasn't until like 9-10 weeks into the school year that she finally had an English teacher. This year, her anatomy teacher, we're talking a higher level science class, her advanced anatomy teacher quit. And there was about a 6 week period where there was no teacher in that classroom. This impacts students' ability to learn. And that's what we should be addressing. And we're seeing those results. SAT and ACT scores are down in Florida compared to where they were 25 years ago. The NAEP scores, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, it's the nation's report card. Florida had a significant drop between fourth and eighth grade in that, bigger than any other state when it comes to reading, math, and science. So we're seeing an impact on our students by these really bad policies. And I want to encourage everyone to think about it this way. We all want what's best for our family. We want to make enough money and have enough income that we can comfortably pay our bills. And we want our kids or our grandkids to get an education so they can better themselves and live a great life in Florida or wherever life takes them, right? And that means they have to have a strong education. So these are connected. This is about family values in our community and what are we going to do to make sure that we have strong, vibrant communities and strong, vibrant families.
Okay, I just want to remind listeners who are just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVTV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, and I'm speaking with Andrew Spahr, who is president of the Florida Education Association. Yeah, that is absolutely right. Now, one question I want to make about the changes to the union stuff, you know, like the last time they did that, you know, the unions, you know, teachers seemed to have responded positively, you know, and you didn't really lose any unions. Are they ready to fight again?
Absolutely. You know, we are working hard to make sure that that our educators in the state of Florida have their rights upheld and protected. And teachers get it and staff get it. The people who work in our schools understand what's going on. They understand we're being targeted for a reason. They understand that there is an attempt to end public education as we know it, to undermine public education and the education of our children. And as educators, we've always fought for a better life for our students, for ourselves, for our families, and we're going to continue to do that. You know, they are trying to make it nearly impossible for educators to carry out their constitutional rights under the Florida Constitution, to be able to come together, form a union, negotiate a contract. They're trying to make it impossible to do so. But we are putting everything we can in this, and that's because educators want a voice. They want to speak up for kids. I became a union member for that reason. I became a union member when I started teaching, because I taught at an inner city school in Daytona Beach. 98% of the students lived in poverty. We were less than 2 miles from the ocean, yet the majority of the students I taught had never been to the beach. They had never been out of their neighborhood, and this was a neighborhood school, a community school. And I saw firsthand how often we had to really come together and speak up to make sure that the students at the school I taught at were getting what they needed. And that's what educators do. That's why we became educators. And we're not going to allow out-of-state billionaires to dictate policy in the state of Florida and allow for politicians to come out and follow billionaire interests and do what billionaire interests wants rather than what the citizens of the state of Florida want. 90% of voters in the state of Florida, whether Republican, Democrat, or no party affiliation, believe we need strong public schools. And greater than 90% believe we need to address the massive teacher and staff shortage. by increasing pay of the teachers and staff and by making sure that they have security in their jobs so that they can stand up and speak up for our kids and our grandkids in this state.
Yeah, you know, important point, because once again, Florida ranked last in the nation in Florida teacher pay. Did the legislature do anything meaningful to address that?
Lou, this is what's so frustrating about the Florida legislature. They had legislation to address some of the inequities with vouchers. It went all the way through the Senate. The House refused to take it up. They had legislation to address some of the challenges we have with the massive teacher and staff shortage, including fixing some of the pay issues. There are over 20 laws that govern how a teacher is paid in the state of Florida. That's crazy. That's micromanaging at its worst. And yet they had legislation to do that. It passed unanimously all the way through the Senate. The House refused to take it up. There was even legislation to give some job security for teachers in the state of Florida because, you know, teachers in the state of Florida technically get a pink slip at the end of every year. And you're seeing that in Sarasota right now where they've talked about eliminating, you know, well over 150 positions in the district, laying people off, which they'll probably end up hiring most of them back because there is such a massive teacher and staff shortage. But they have to go through that process, and because there isn't a level of job security for our educators, and it's why they won't come into the profession anymore or are getting out, because who wants to work under the condition where every year you don't know what the next year is going to bring you? You go work anywhere else, you have a job, and they have to take action to end your job. But educators in the state of Florida, you have a job that has an end date. And it's the end of every school year. And you have to wait until the district says, okay, yes, we'll bring you back. That level of uncertainty is not healthy for us, and it's certainly not good for students who need a stable teaching force to know that there are people there who care about them, who are going to look out for them, who they can trust. And so there was legislation to fix that as well. Got all the way through the Senate unanimously. The House refused to take it up. We have dysfunction in Tallahassee. They couldn't even do the one thing they're required to do, which is pass a budget. They said they were going to come back after Easter and do that. They don't even have a date to come back and do that. This legislature is failing the people of the state of Florida. And you know what? I think voters get it. We saw it in some special elections that happened a couple of weeks ago where a union guy, a union electrician, won a Senate seat in the Tampa Bay area.
In Hillsborough County,
where that was held by the lieutenant governor prior. And that was a flip of a district because people are saying we need to have the everyday person in Tallahassee instead of the typical politician who's all about where the money's coming from and not about the struggle that we have every day in the state of Florida.
Of course, and we can't forget mention Emily Gregory, who won in Palm Beach County.
Yep.
And that was kind of fantastic and interesting.
Yes.
You know, and what that shows, but you know, now, but instead, though, you know, and this has been proposed, and we're going to vote on it, I guess, in November. You know, the legislature wants to cut or lower property taxes. Now, they claim those property taxes that are going to be lowered do not involve school taxes that are collected as property taxes. But what impact is this going to have on teacher pay and financing of public schools? Because some of that property tax does go to schools through communities, right? I mean, explain how that happens.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things we need to recognize. First of all, the legislature didn't even get that done. The House passed legislation to put an initiative on the ballot related to eliminating some level of property taxes. The Senate did not do that. They're saying they're going to have a special session to do that too. But again, nothing's been announced yet. You have the governor saying we should eliminate all property taxes. He's even gone as far to say all property taxes, including school property taxes. Well, school property taxes right now, your local property taxes fund more than 50% of school districts right now. And because the state has continued to cut their share in education. And so That could have a devastating impact on public schools. But to your point, any elimination, we eliminate property taxes in the state. You know, these are taxes that your cities operate under, that your counties operate under, that law enforcement operates under. And in a lot of our schools, there's partnerships between cities or between the county and the school district to provide security, additional security at our schools. What does that look like? If they have to start implementing fees, there's a lot of schools that use city parks or county parks for various activities and events, cross country, for example. When kids run cross country, a lot of times they're maybe in a city park that they're doing that or a county park. Those all will have impacts on our schools. And of course, they're going to have impacts on us in our communities as well. And so, right now, polling doesn't show any of those kinds of things passing. So it's interesting to see how this will play out. But there's no doubt that revenue is an issue in the state of Florida. We're 45th in the nation out of the 50 states in funding for our public schools. We don't need to cut further. And voters in the state of Florida, including in Sarasota and in Manatee County, they continue to vote to add property taxes to fund our schools in referendum so that those areas are able to pay their teachers and staff more.
That's right. Well, you know, even though there's one last thing, you know, I just want to ask you about, you know, recently, AG James Uthmeer, you know, has declared that the state will not enforce any laws on the books that prevent it from financing religious schools. I know that's going to be challenged in court. What's that all about?
Look, it's all about the same thing. What I was talking about earlier, this is all about how to dismantle public education. That's what this is about. This is about dismantling public education and goes against every element that I read earlier in the Constitution of the State of Florida. Article 9, Section 1 makes it clear. We, the people of this state, have demanded strong public schools, and you have these political hacks, because remember, the Attorney General in the state of Florida was not elected to that position. He was appointed to that position by the governor, even though it's an elected position. He does have to run for re-election this November, but he's made it clear he has a political job to do, not the job of Attorney General representing the people of the state of Florida, but the job representing a political ideology, and that's what he continues to demonstrate, and unfortunately too many of these other folks do as well.
Okay, well, on that note, you know, I want to thank you, Andrew Spahr, for making time for us today, and please tell my listeners how they can learn more about these important issues and what the FEA is about and doing.
Yeah, absolutely. You can visit the FEA website, which is www.feaweb.org, feaweb.org. You can find the Florida Education Association or myself, Andrew Spahr, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Blue Sky, on Instagram, and you can also find me on TikTok.
Beautiful. Thanks again for coming on, Andrew, and I expect we'll be speaking again at some point.
Absolutely, Lou. Have a great day. Take care.
You too. Great. Bye-bye.
Yet again, Florida is finishing in the top tier of states with a dubious distinction. This time, it's the cost of homeowners insurance. The only surprise is that Florida wasn't number one. Florida homeowners may be familiar with high insurance costs in the state, brought on in part by the Sunshine State's predilection for hurricanes. But while Florida ranks high for homeowners insurance rate costs, there are actually two other states that rank even higher, according to a recent report by Bankrate. In the February report, researchers looked at insurance rates from across all 50 states to determine which areas had the highest average annual premiums for dwelling coverage. Overall, Florida came in third, a yearly average of $5,800. Florida's notoriously tough market for homeowners insurance due to the state's risk level. The report reads, the Sunshine State's long coastline and narrow shape means that much of the state is at risk for hurricane damage, wind damage, and flooding. Sinkholes are also a danger to Florida homes. However, the two top most expensive states turned out to be Nebraska, number one, and Louisiana, number two, with average premiums of over $6,200. Summers can be rough in Nebraska. The state ranks as one of the worst for hail, which can damage a home's exterior and lead to interior water damage. Strong storms can bring high winds, tornadoes, and flash floods. Louisiana's coastal position puts it at risk for widespread hurricane and flood damage. Hurricane Katrina was the costliest hurricane in U.S. history and caused devastating damage to New Orleans and surrounding areas. Tornadoes are relatively common in the state as well. Ranking 51 in homeowner insurance was Vermont, with an average cost of $829, which is $1,597